trusted voice of truth and light.
God gave me a gift. I shovel well. I shovel very well.
And a rally point for those who've accepted the reality that they are not sheep.
We've got a blind date with destiny.
And it looks like she's ordered the lobster.
This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Well, hello there and welcome to the show. You know, this program exists because I know there are people out there who are doing their honest best to try to find factual, credible, non-agendized information which can help them better understand the world around them. How do I know this? Because I'm one of them. I'm working day and night to try to make sense of what's happening around us to position myself and my loved ones to, well, first of all, be able to get through it all, but most importantly, to do it with as many of our freedoms intact as possible. Now, that requires some awareness. It also requires some willingness to face unpleasant facts. But most importantly, it requires a willingness to think for ourselves. And I suspect that's why you listen to programs such as this one, not so I can tell you what to think, but so that you can get a better idea of what's going on and then decide for yourself, does this information add up or not? Whatever the reason, I'm glad you're part of our audience. You know, I saw a tweet by the musician Zuby, and I'm really grateful I started following this guy on Twitter just because he really has some great insights, and he has just soared in popularity. Some people hate his guts. That's the price you pay. You know, when you start making waves, you know, you're going to attract the haters as well as people who appreciate it. Listen to this observation that he had a few days ago. Zuby said, if somebody had written a dystopian novel that followed the events of 2019 to 2021, then it would have been panned for being too unrealistic, too incoherent, and having too many plot holes. You'd be like, this makes no sense. People aren't that stupid. Think about what he's saying. And the crazy thing is, I think he's right. If somebody 2 years ago had told us, hey, guys, here's what lies ahead. Here's what the next couple of years are going to be like. This is what it's going to be like for you as 2022 starts out. Most of us would have shook our heads in disbelief and just said, get on some better meds. Seriously. Yet here we are. And there are so many things coming at us. How do you know what's worth focusing on? What's just fear porn? In other words, what is being used just to keep me scared, uncertain, you know, off balance? Well, let's start with the free speech. I think it's as good a place as any to start today, since this program, and like many others like it, depends on free speech. And, you know, it's more than just a lofty ideal. It's more than just a convenient loophole to, you know, sit there and make noise in the public square. Free speech is an essential part of your freedom of conscience. And I've got a great editorial here from the board at Issues and Insights, warning about the murdering of free speech in America. Listen to this take. They say, in Cato's 15th letter, the writers who compiled a series of essays under a pen name inspired by the Roman senator who stood against the tyranny of Julius Caesar, argued that freedom of speech is the great bulwark of liberty. They prosper and die together. And the editorial board members say today we are watching that death play out before us. President Joe Biden, whose growing unpopularity is well-deserved, continued to carry on last week in what has become a Democratic tradition. He asked the private sector to become partners in censorship with the federal government. Biden said during a virtual meeting from the Eisenhower Executive Office Building, I make a special appeal to social media companies and media outlets. Please deal with disinformation and misinformation that's on your shows. It has to stop. Now, of course, big tech and the legacy media have been happy to oblige. Journalist Glenn Greenwald tweeted in response to Biden's will no one rid me of this meddlesome priest proposition. He asked when the leader of the majority party in Washington, D.C. issues a demand, the largest corporations listen. Now, again, so much of the censorship from Google and other tech monopolies is not done on their own accord, but rather under pressure and threats from Democratic Party leaders. Now, nearly a year ago, Greenwald wrote in his Substack newsletter that in their zeal for control over online speech, House Democrats are getting closer and closer to the constitutional line if they've not already crossed it. Now, he was referring to the third time in less than 5 months that lawmakers had summoned the CEOs of social media companies to appear before them with the explicit intent to pressure and coerce them to censor more content from their platforms. A few months later, the Biden administration announced that government officials are working directly with Facebook to limit the spread of misinformation. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki admitted we're flagging problematic posts for Facebook. Meaning the White House press corps, the White House itself is flagging posts for Facebook. And then there's Senator Richard Blumenthal, the Democrat from Connecticut, who has demanded, according to George Washington University law professor Jonathan Turley, that big tech companies commit to even more robust content modification. That's an Orwellian term for censorship. And Turley adds, the public is now required to discuss public controversies within the lines and limits set by corporate censors with the guidance of the government. Well, there you go. That's as clear and concise an explanation as you're likely to get. Well, the editorial board at Issues and Insights says we believe that private companies have the right to determine who may and who may not participate in their forums. And our free press is at liberty to publish or not publish whatever it wishes. As others have said, it's just business, but it can also be personal. That's just the messiness of freedom. But when social media and the press are censoring at the behest of the government, when they become agents of the state, the threat to the First Amendment is real. Now, tyrants have always feared and suppressed speech. And the Democratic Party is lousy with authoritarians who want not to govern but to rule as a single party. We see this in not only their pressure on the private sector to rid them of meddlesome characters who express ideas and make statements they don't like, but also in their legislative agendas. They have an insatiable lust for permanent, unfettered control of government at all levels. That's the democracy, in quotation marks, that Democrats keep talking about saving in the next election. They crave it so intensely, they're willing to kill freedom of speech in exchange for a throne. You know, the crazy thing about this, a very dear friend of mine called it perfectly back in 2016. In fact, he called it the day after Donald Trump was elected. Reached out to me and said, hey, have you seen the reaction from the left over Trump getting elected? And of course, at that time, there was a lot of tears. There was a lot of going on, people, you know, losing their minds. And I said, yeah, I see it. People are not happy. And he said, mark my words. He says, when the Democrats get back into power, he says, they're going to lock this thing down and make sure that no one except who they approve of is ever going to get close to that power again. And at the time I was like, oh, well, I could see where, you know, they're upset enough. They might do something rash, but that's exactly what they've done. And it's a point, unfortunately, that was lost on a lot of people who don't understand. The pendulum swings. And sometimes it tends to hang, you know, a little more to one side than the other, but it always swings back. And this is the voter rights bills that the Democrats are so desperate to pass. And I think desperation is exactly the right word to use here. Have everything to do with nationalizing our elections and putting that control absolutely in the hands of the federal government. One size fits all. Everybody else, shut up and sit down. We'll tell you when we need you. Totally at odds with the concept of federalism, meaning the states are primarily responsible for the day-to-day governance, and that would largely include, you know, managing their own elections. And the federal government only deals with those things that it's specifically empowered to deal with in the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8. Period. Full stop. So I don't know if they're going to succeed in doing this, even if they did. I mean, look, if people didn't have doubts in elections before, if they weren't wondering, well, hey, are we sure this process is as open and transparent as they claim it's going to be? I mean, you can't even question it. How dare you even say something that undermines our democracy? I agree with the Issues and Insights Board. Their editorial board nailed it. It's not a matter of democracy. It's about control. This threatens our control. And right now there are some folks who are very much determined to be in control. If that means they have to burn down the house with us in it, well, then that's what they're willing to do. I mean, look, there are some issues in my life where I want to be the control freak, where I am the control freak. Now, I've spent a lot of years learning how to hunt down and root out that little tyrant in my soul that wants control of things. And things got a lot more peaceful. Life got better. I'm just going to say, I think it's a worthwhile thing to not be the tyrant, but also to recognize when someone is trying to be a tyrant to you.
This is the Brian Hyde Show. This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Hey, welcome back to the show. Want to give a quick shout out to my sponsors, including lifesavingfood.com, also the Heather Turner team at Patriot Home Mortgage, HSLAmmo.com, SewingAndQuiltingCenter.com, GovernYourIncome.com, and MonticelloCollege.org. By the way, if you want to subscribe to the show notes, and I want to tell you how happy I am every time I go to my email and I see, oh, look, I've got more subscribers. All you have to do to subscribe, go to my website, thebrianhydeshow.com. You'll see a place you can click for show notes. Click on the latest show notes down at the bottom of the page is a subscribe button. Now, all it's going to ask you for is your email, which I will not sell or will not give or trade or lend to anybody else. You're not going to get harassed with a bunch of ads, you know, from different third parties. All this is going to result in is me sending you the show notes so you can check them out for yourself. So if that's of interest to you, please subscribe. I will be happy to add your name to my email list and happy to send this out every day that I do the show. So I think I've made it pretty clear. Not a fan of politics. In fact, as I watch people lose faith in our political institutions, that may be horrifying to some people, but to me, it's actually a very encouraging sign. That's a sign that people are actually waking up. And it actually spells some very authentic opportunity for the entrepreneurial revolutionaries. These are the good kind, by the way, that are among us. Got an article here from, Max Borders, published on the American Institute for Economic Research website. Politics is dead. Now what? This is such a great essay. He lists Persia, Rome, Britain. History is a record of cycles of growth and decline. And then he asks, is America any exception? If indeed we're starting to see the first perturbations of the American fall, then we'd better be prepared. But preparation, he says, needn't all be canned food and stocked basements. It could simply be a collective readiness to undertake an enormous restructuring. Now, Max Borders says, I've been calling the death of politics for nearly a decade now. I don't need to repeat that sorry appraisal here. He actually links to his previous essay where he talks about the death of politics. He says, it's becoming more evident to everyone. Content about how people have lost faith in the institutions has become a cottage industry. But has anyone considered the possibility that the institutions have outlived their usefulness? See, technocracy always fails in time, yet the powerful cling to power. So anyone who claims politics is dead needs to answer the question, okay, now what? The answer is entrepreneurship, and that, of course, includes innovation. Our mantra is criticize by creating, which he says I shamelessly stole from educational entrepreneur Michael Strong, who stole it from Michelangelo. And he says, you should steal it too. It might well be the mantra of this renaissance. So here's the idea. If you're engaged in politics, policy, and punditry, you're probably not moving the needle. At best, you're running as fast as you can to stay in the same place. At worst, you're proving why people have lost faith in the institutions. To make enduring change, you have to do something hard. You have to create something the constituencies adopt so readily. It puts another crack in the institutions. Indeed, instead of trying to preserve the institutions, let them sink into the dark waters of time. Now, here he talks about the practices. He says, elsewhere, I've referred to this more active process as subversive innovation. But instead of referring to it in passing, he says, I want to take the opportunity to describe it as a set of basic practices. Some will be familiar, perhaps, but I hope some will be new. Number one, he says, embrace Michael Strong's law and corollary. So here's Strong's law. Ceteris paribus, properly structured free enterprise always results over time in higher quality, lower cost, and more customized products and services. Here's Strong's corollary. This theorem applies just as forcefully to the entrepreneurial supply of law, governance, community, housing, education, healthcare, happiness, and well-being as it does to technology. Our world suffers because we've not allowed entrepreneurial initiative to fully address humanity's most important issues. Now he says, got that? If not, feel free to read it again, which I'm linking to this in the show notes, so you can do that if you need to. Number two, he talks about developing a sharp customer focus from which you reverse engineer everything else. First, you have to find your customer and become intimate with her need/desire. Then, what problem are you solving for your customer? What value are you creating for your customer? Now, if your answer trails off or involves too many interconnected abstractions, systems, or customer types, you're probably building a sky castle. You must stay laser-focused on the customer's needs and desires at all times. There's nothing more important. Number three, let purpose be your boss, but let profit be your profit. Two different spellings. Even nonprofit organizations have to earn revenues over costs to survive. So first, you have to establish your organization's purpose. And that purpose should be a solemn and severe master you slavishly serve. Profit, then, is a measurement of your success using resources wisely in serving that purpose. Now, he says, note, if your organization's purpose is at odds with customer focus, you must realign. To the extent your organization is unprofitable, it's an indicator something is wrong. That is, you're wasting resources or your organization is undercapitalized. The hard part of being an entrepreneur is to know the difference. Still, profit isn't evil. It's an indication that you can sustainably create customer value. Number four, what is the least you can do? That is, what is a prototype or minimum viable product that you can take to market quickly for a low-cost test? Now, if the primary objective is satisfying your customers' wants and needs, then not far behind should be to fail early and cheaply so you can go back to the drawing board. If you find early success, you can build on that success by taking your venture to scale or recruiting someone who can. Never try to boil the ocean and don't fall for calls to moonshot thinking. It's mostly BS. Number five, locate the failure and do better than the legacy system. Most entrepreneurs want the path of least resistance, so they're going to steer clear of heavily regulated industries or sectors with giant incumbents. No more. Even areas the centralists claim are to be provided by the state, things like welfare, money, and governance itself, are the areas hungry for subversive innovation. Dare to go into those areas, even if you have to solve a problem within some legal gray area, kind of like Uber did. If you can solve part of a bigger problem, you can still create value and build upon that success later. Next, he says, expect failure, but keep going. Failure can be demoralizing, but it's part of a bigger process of experimentation and discovery. If you can set up your venture to fail early and cheaply, such will be less taxing on your body and soul. Patience and persistence will put you in a better position to succeed in the long run. Number seven, find your complementary team. No one should try to undertake a venture alone. A basic set of entrepreneurial types is visionaries, implementers, and marketers. Visionaries use their big brains to see the big picture and keep their eyes on the horizon, but they can get lost in the details. Implementers make the trains run on time and can execute the details, but can let details and processes distract from the vision. Marketers understand people and are savvy at communicating the value both inside and outside the organization, but they can't always make things happen. Together, though, these three types can make magic. Number eight, always be branding. When it comes to branding, most entrepreneurs are the visual equivalent of those poor souls on American Idol who nobody told they're tone deaf. The difference is nobody finds it funny. Your brand is your front door. It speaks volumes before you can. Your brand should do 80% of the communication before you ever enter the picture. Some entrepreneurs sally forth with a potentially valuable product or service, but they only know how to be a transmitter. They haven't a clue how to think like a receiver. Now, to be a receiver, you put yourself in the minds of your customers and you ask yourself, how are they likely to interpret what you are transmitting? So you have to brand everything, starting with your investor deck. And always be sure to practice the KISS simple. KISS principle, rather. Keep it simple, stupid. If you think you might be brand blind, like tone deaf, find someone capable of helping you develop your brand. Now, I realize this may not be for everybody, but this strikes me as some really good advice. We'll come back to this article in just a few moments. Please stay with us.
This is the Brian Hyde Show. This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Hey, welcome back to the show. Quick shout out here for lifesavingfood.com. I beat the drum for food storage for a lot of years, and I don't just beat the drum, I actually practice what I preach. I thrive on knowing that I have the equivalent of a small supermarket there in my storeroom, where if I need something, whether it's food, whether it's soap, whether it's cooking oil, I have something I can turn to. But what really gives me peace of mind is knowing that I have long-term food storage, stuff that can sit there for 20, 25 years and still be good and still be consumable and tasty. That's important too. So if this is something that sounds like it would bring peace to you, help you sleep better at night, not knowing what exactly lies ahead, well, I would encourage you, go to the website, lifesavingfood.com. Check out what they have to offer. Whether you're looking for big or small solutions, they can help you. And you'll get a 20% discount, no sales tax, and free delivery. There's a little added incentive to make that happen. Lifesavingfood.com. So I'm sharing this article from Max Borders. Politics is dead, now what? And he is listing off a number of rules that innovators and entrepreneurs could be taking advantage of in order to use these uncertain times where there's a lot of shifting and institutions, people are losing faith in them. By the way, that's perfectly in keeping with that fourth turning methodology. That's one of the signs of a fourth turning is the institutions that people counted on, they no longer count on. In fact, those institutions often are swept away and replaced with something else. The question is it going to be better or worse than what we had before? See, and that's something where you and I can actually have a say. So he's been listing off all these different rules that go along with how to get out there and create something in an entrepreneurial revolution. Number 9 in his suggested rules here. Think locally, but you might have to act globally. Max Borders says subversive innovators sometimes dream up their ventures in jurisdictions hostile to their goals. Can you deploy your innovation in another more hospitable jurisdiction? Even within the U.S., some states are better than others, especially for decentralized finance. See Wyoming. Other jurisdictions are better about certain kinds of secrecy. See Nevada. However, if you're thinking about innovating in ways that challenge the status quo, you might consider any number of offshore locations. Establishing a winning venture in another jurisdiction could help create the future for the one you're in. And number 10 in his rules, he says, remain steadfast. Entrepreneurship has an associated set of virtues. One of the most important is courage. There will be predators and parasites that threaten to tear down what you build. Sadly, they are the enemy. Your effort to serve customers and create value is part of the new great war, but don't be afraid. Instead, imagine letting the centralists win that war. Living in a world of surveillance, control, and equal poverty should instill more fear than functionaries' threats and activists' online paroxysms. Gird your loins and prepare to criticize by creating. And he finishes with one of the most mind-expanding concepts that I've seen in quite a while. Subject, citizen, customer. Now, the word customer has a neutral or sometimes negative connotation. It can be associated with the commercial domain in general or specifically to some sleazy car salesman who promises great customer service. But when we consider the three major types of relationships between an individual and an organization, It should open our eyes. I've never had this explained this way, but this makes perfect sense. If you are a subject, the primary relationship is one of obedience. If you are a citizen, the primary relationship is acting in an illusion of consent, then obedience. Ouch. I know, that one stung. If you are a customer, the primary relationship is one of consent. This makes sense, right? Because a customer, when they walk into a store and they're looking for shoes and they're like, all right, well, I really don't see anything that I like. It's not like the clerk in the store can pull a gun on them and say, now hold up there. You're going to buy these brown shoes and you're not leaving the store without buying them. They can't do that. You can simply walk out the door and go find a store that sells shoes that you do like and purchase from them. Government doesn't give you that option. Now, it does give you the illusion of consent. Well, we're going to hold an election. In fact, we're going to hold an election that was founded on election rights and voting rights. And we control every bit of it, including, you know, limiting you to this choice between candidate A and candidate B, both of whom happen to be owned by the system. You get the picture. So, yeah, it really is an illusion of consent without actually giving you the effects of consent. Try to walk away from government. At some point, somebody will pull a gun on you and say, now hold up there. I realize that's going to upset some people, but I still think it's a true statement. So there are the three different relationships. And Max Border says, such implies that the very idea of a public servant is largely a myth, and it's time to change the connotation of customer. I mean, I've heard government compared to the squeegee man, will come up to your car at a stoplight in the city. While you're sitting there waiting, desperately waiting for the light to change, here comes the squeegee man muttering to himself and squirting stuff on your windshield and smearing it around with his squeegee, and then puts out his hand and demands payment. Give me money! Can't you see what I've done for you? Government operates with that same sense of forcing something on you that you really don't want and then demanding you pay for it or else. Now, fortunately, all the squeegee man can do is maybe throw something at you or yell at you as you drive away when the light changes. Government will hunt you down and find a way to make you pay, and if you resist, ultimately will kill you in order to bring you into submission. Max Border says, citizens and subjects are an afterthought, whatever stories we tell ourselves in civics class. If I am associated with a profit-seeking organization that renounces rent-seeking, trying to get its money from government, I must serve those who choose to associate with me. If I'm associated with a coercive state bureaucracy, I must serve a master with taxing authority, meaning men with guns and jails. Now, this rationale extends to the civil society sector as well. Yes, it can be difficult to maintain two sets of customers, donors and clients. But solving such problems makes for better entrepreneurs whose fundamental imperative is still service. Now, these are fundamentally different relationships, and the preponderance of one or the other gives rise to the health or dysfunction of society. That's why a revolution in entrepreneurship, subversive innovation, is the tip of the spear for societal change. Never forget that you are launching your attack from the highest moral ground of all, consent. Your enemies will have to fight you from the low perch of compulsion. Yeah, I admit it. I'm a big fan of the free market, and I'm especially a fan of consent versus compulsion. I'll have a link to this in the show notes. I think this is worth a couple of reads. I hope it's something that you will take to heart. Speaking of take to heart, I want to share with you some of the best advice that I have ever received. And I think this is necessary advice for anybody who is determined to stand up and speak out because the times demand that they stand up and speak out. And it's the advice to never complain, never explain. Now, this is an article that was published, about 6 years ago on the website Art of Manliness. And if you have ever had to deal with critics, this is going to be some of the most useful information you will ever find. Never complain, never explain. Brett McKay, actually Brett and Kate McKay, the authors of this article, say this pithy little maxim was first coined by the British politician and Prime Minister Benjamin Disraeli and adopted as a motto by many other high-ranking Brits. from members of royalty to Navy admirals to fellow prime ministers Stanley Baldwin and Winston Churchill. The maxim well encompasses the stiff upper-lipped lipness of the Victorian age, but the timeless wisdom it contains has made it a guiding mantra of powerful, confident, accountability-prizing men throughout the modern day. Now, the nevers, of course, aren't ironclad, and they don't apply to every situation, and even where they should apply, they can be hard to follow through on. But understanding when, where, and why to apply this maxim is truly a great help in becoming a more autonomous and assertive man. Or woman. Because I'm thinking this would apply to both. Its four words pack a lot of truth in a small space and work on a few different levels. So let's unpack them, starting with the meat of the matter, never explain, and then working backward. Now they begin with a quote here from Elbert Hubbard, "Never explain. Your friends do not need it, and your enemies will not believe you anyway." And this is where I'm going to tap the brakes and just ask you, you know, as you have probably just gone about living your life, you've more than likely had to explain things to people. Why haven't you been vaxxed? Why haven't you, you know, put on a mask? Why haven't you done this or done that? And there are some people that deserve an explanation, but there are a lot of people who don't. Could you make yourself look weaker? Could you put yourself unwittingly under their control merely by trying to come up with an explanation that you hope they would find acceptable? Maybe you don't need their permission at all. We'll come back to this wonderful article. It's linked in the show notes at thebrianhydeshow.com. Stay with us.
This is The Brian Hyde Show. This is The Brian Hyde Show.
Hey, welcome back to the show, my fellow wrong thinker. Sorry, I had a little moment of puberty love. Must be something going around. You guys heard of any bugs or anything that anybody's been dealing with? All right, just checking. So this is the article, Never Complain, Never Explain. And Brett and Kate McKay start with Never Explain. And they tell the story of Winston Churchill as a young cavalry officer, always looking for ways to get to the front and experience battle firsthand. And with much persistence, he eventually secured a position in the field as a personal assistant to Sir William Lockhart, who was overseeing the British's military campaigns in what's now Pakistan. Now, when Churchill first joined the general staff, he behaved and was treated as befitted his youth and subordinate station. But one day he saw an opportunity to offer a bit of advice that led to him being taken into the much more confidential circles of the staff and treated as if I were quite a grown-up. See, Churchill had heard that the general in his headquarters had been hurt and angry to hear that a newspaper correspondent who had been sent home from their camp had published a very critical article about one of their recent campaigns. The officers smarted at what they felt were unfair charges, and the chief of staff had written up a thorough rebuttal and mailed it off to the newspaper to be published. Churchill spoke up at once and tried to convince the staff that such a move was ultimately a bad idea and that the piece ought to be intercepted before it was ever printed. Here's what Churchill said. "I said that it would be considered most undignified and even improper for a high officer on the staff of the army in the field to enter into newspaper controversy about the conduct of operations with a dismissed war correspondent. That I was sure the government would be surprised and the War Office furious that Army staff were expected to leave their deference to their superiors or to the politicians, and that no matter how good the arguments were, the mere fact of advancing them would be everywhere taken as a sign of weakness." Now, in this, as in many things, Churchill turned out to be quite prescient and wise. Offering explanations does indeed demonstrate weakness for several reasons. First of all, explaining gives power to another. When someone criticizes or insults you, gets offended by something you do or say, or questions your decisions and why you've chosen to do something a certain way, it's natural to want to explain why you think they're wrong, especially if said party has impinged on your integrity or honor, and some kind of response may indeed be in order. Now, if that person is someone you know and respect as an equal, someone you consider to be inside your circle of honor, and they've said something intelligent and interesting, you may want to explain yourself in order to invite further discussion. If they're your boss or a customer. You may need to offer an explanation to hold on to your job or to hold on to their business. If there's someone you care about, a loved one or a friend, and you've had a gross miscommunication, you may want to explain yourself in an effort to preserve the relationship. But if the critical, offended, slash skeptical party is someone you don't know personally, like a stranger online or the public in general, someone you don't care about or you don't respect as an equal, someone who shouldn't have any say or sway over your choices, well, then taking the time to explain why they're wrong or why you've made the decisions you have is ill-advised. To be concerned with what someone outside your circle of respect thinks is to allow yourself to be pulled down to his or her level. See, explaining yourself is essentially an attempt to seek another's approval. It shows you're stung that they've withdrawn that approval and desirous of getting it back. When you show that you care about an opinion that you and any observers know you really shouldn't, you show weakness. In losing the fight between trying to ignore them and craving the catharsis of engagement, you demonstrate a failure of self-control. Further, when a chucklehead elicits a response, you validate his importance. He's made you do something against your better judgment. You've given to him two of your most precious resources, your time and attention. You've gone from the offensive to the defensive. His status goes up and yours goes down. Now, people, whether irrationally angry customers, estranged family members, or a controlling significant other, will often demand explanations for what you do. They'll say you're weak if you don't offer one. But this is the cleverest of ploys. By targeting your pride, they get you to hand over your power. Now, of course, restraining yourself from responding to someone who's goading you on is easier said than done. As someone who's subjected to a constant barrage of feedback on my work day after day, Brett McKay says I'm able to find that I'm able to successfully ignore about 98% of it. It's when someone says something that impinges on my honor, even when I know they're not part of my honor group, or when they seem like a dude that I can have a good debate with, that's when I get into trouble. Now, when someone's clearly off their rocker, it's easy to ignore them as really out there. And when someone has something critical but intelligent to say, engaging them can actually be interesting and instructive. But it's the people who greatly distort who you are, what you did, what you said, but mix together sensible-sounding discourse with nuggets of crazy who prove the most irresistible. They almost sound like someone you could have a reasonable discussion with. It almost seems like you could explain to them why they're objectively off the mark. But as it invariably turns out, and this is a lesson he says I've had to learn over and over, if someone's mindset or mentality is such that they're able to grossly misinterpret something, no amount of explanation, no matter how thorough and well-reasoned, is going to change their mind. Quite to the contrary, they'll simply dig in their heels all the more. So never complain, never explain, doesn't necessarily mean not saying anything to your doubters, complainers, and critics, but limiting your response to a sharp rejoinder. Disraeli, in fact, formulated his maxim after hearing the advice of fellow politician Lord Lyndhurst, who said, never defend yourself before a popular assembly except with and by retorting an attack. Thus, a short, pithy rebuttal or humorous yet withering sarcastic quip, Churchill, by the way, was a master of these, may be in order. Then you turn heel and don't engage further. Of course, even a simple retort may draw you into an argument you never wanted to have, which often makes complete silence the best possible response. In fact, nothing drives someone nipping at your heels crazier than to have their questions and demands go utterly ignored and unacknowledged. This is very sound advice. And for many years when I wrote for St. George News, I developed a little cadre of people who would follow me around from column to column. At one point I was publishing two columns a week, and just, it doesn't matter what I said. If I said, you know, the sky is blue, they would rush, no, the sky is light blue, you know, and just do everything in their power to try to goad me into some kind of a response. And sadly, in the early years, I would sometimes take the bait. But I found that by applying this advice about don't respond to the one who's nipping at your heels, that yappy little dog that's down there trying to get your attention. If it's not somebody whose opinion you trust, if it's not somebody who's there to offer constructive criticism, you owe them nothing. And it was really interesting. There was one in particular I don't know. I hope this person has found an outlet to be heard. But man, they would write these long, incredible, expansive, you know, explanations of why Hyde is wrong and an extremist and so forth, and just dare me to respond, and I never did. And you could see it driving them crazy. I mean, they started coming up with conspiracies. Well, you know, I think Hyde is actually a secret commenter on here, and I haven't been able to prove it yet, but I have my hunch that it's, you know, that he's got some kind of a game afoot. And I'm like, yeah, the game afoot is you're spinning your wheels and you're pushing buttons that are connected to nothing. And by not giving a response, I was denying this individual the reaction that he or she was so desperately looking for. Now, if it sounds like it took some pleasure in it, I did. It was satisfying to see them have a come apart, but at the same time, I was applying some very good knowledge here, which is don't explain yourself to people for whom it really makes no difference. Explaining demonstrates a lack of confidence in your choices, your creations, and your principles. And explanations can also turn very easily into excuses. Now, as far as never complain, I'm not really going to have time to get into this part of the essay, but I would really recommend go to my show notes at thebrianhydeshow.com and read this for yourself. One of the reasons you don't want to complain is because you can talk yourself into defeat. You can actually snatch victory from the jaws of defeat. You can snatch defeat from the jaws of victory, actually, too. Don't complain. In the sense that if it's just, you know, we all want to vent, right? When things don't go right, we just need to get it off our chest. But if you're looking to convince people about something, action will beat complaining every single time. Again, this is one of the most useful essays that I have ever read. I've shared it before with my listeners, but I assume there are probably some new ears that are hearing this for the first time. If you want to be an autonomous individual, you want to learn how to trust your judgment, this is one of the things you got to get your mind around. There are some people that you simply do not owe an explanation to. Anybody with that gotcha mentality, who's just looking for a weakness, looking for some excuse to pounce. Ah, you misspelled this word. Ah, therefore everything you've said is wrong. You're not going to be able to reason with such people. Don't dignify them with a response. Let them fade into irrelevance and focus on the ones who are listening.
This is the Brian Hyde Show.